fire, leaving Babylon and trying to escape this Utah. Who child, this country jungle is too wild. That's why we got more than two stars. To adapt in the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungle is specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom." And with all that, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live stream there also. You can go to OurRadioNetwork.com. Again, that's OurRadioNetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And then a TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace with our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Different African language classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight is 7:08 here in the city of Philadelphia, and a Sunday edition program is in full effect. A special guest this evening, London-based journalist and oral historian Brian Knight will be with us. It was an interesting article that Mr. Knight had in Al Jazeera titled "The Danger of Depoliticizing Black Power Activism." We'll talk about that and some of his other articles and important topics. When we come back, we'll have our guests join us, and you can always join the conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:14 in the city of Philadelphia. And before we get started with our program, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to Brother Knight's discussion around his article and just what he's been developing in a few articles that he's written in the spirit.
Yes, it's very interesting because, you know, we've been talking about this topic, Richard, I don't know, for eons now. And periodically we bring on guests. In fact, Charles Barron, I think about a month ago, was the last guest that we had talking about this in and around this particular subject. I think it's always an important topic to bring up, because whenever we talk about sovereignty, independence, our people moving towards decolonizing their mind, this subject seems to come up. The politics of it all, put it that way. I think it's interesting. I ran across this article in Al Jazeera, because I try to scan other media besides, you know, the media here in the United States, and ran across this particular article. And through a little further research, I found out that one of our frequent guests, Brother Obi Egbona Jr., was on Brother Knight's program. I guess it is over there in England. And then I reached out to him, and he put us in touch with one another. And I'm glad to have him on with us tonight. That's London-based journalist and oral historian. Brother Brian Knight is with us. Brother Brian, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, how are you doing?
How are you, sir? I'm glad to have you on Time for an Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
Oh, well, it's great to be on the show. Thank you.
Great to hear.
Brother Knight, listen, before we get started, talking about your article and a few of your articles, talk a little bit about yourself. Brother Obi told me a little bit about you. I seen a little bio in the article that was in Al Jazeera, but give us a little background on yourself, Brother Brian.
Well, I would describe myself as a journalist first and foremost, but I'm also an oral historian who specializes in Black British history. So for the past 2 years, I've been researching the British Black Power movement and themes of Black internationalism, and looking at how the United States Black Power came together and formed this international movement that was much bigger and much wider than just an American-focused ideology. So that's some of the work that I've been doing.
Yeah, Brother Knight, you're a young man, you're in your 20s, you write for several publications. I ran across this one in Al Jazeera, which is not an American publication, it's an international publication. The impetus in you writing these particular articles, and you know, I don't want to stereotype our people, but sometimes you run across young people and older people, their mind is not into looking into these things. Sometimes our minds are clouded by other things, and believe me, it's reasons for all of that. But talk about what made you start searching this particular portions of our history out.
Well, I've been interested in history for a long time, throughout my entire time in education. But I always felt there was something lacking, something that wasn't quite clicking with my interest. And when I was at university, I had the pleasure of having an entire module on Black British history. And in one of the lectures that I had, I came across the British Black Panther movement. And this was a huge revelation for me, because for a long time I'd been taught about Stokely Carmichael and about the American Black Power movement, but I'd never heard of Black radical resistance in Britain. And when I started looking into it and reading about people like Darcus Howe and Althea Jones LeQuant, I realized that Britain had its own Black radical tradition. And it's got me thinking about ways that I could help unearth this history, because I think it's such a shame that so many people like myself go throughout their formative education period without learning this history. And I think there's a political reason behind that. So in my work, I'm motivated by uncovering this and getting people to think about their circumstances differently, but also foregrounding it with the history that came before.
Were your parents involved were the activists, were they involved in kind of pushing you towards uncovering your history, your background, things of that nature, or tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've definitely got to credit my parents for getting me to think outside the box.
Okay.
So ever since I was a young child, I was getting that education about colonialism from home. I myself am from Kenya. That's where I was born. So my mom always instilled these histories into me and got me to think outside the Western standard history that I was being taught at school. So yes, definitely they've shaped my interests and shaped the way that I view the world.
Okay. Let's get into the some of the article. Unless, Richard, you want to ask a couple more questions?
Oh, yeah, we can. Yeah, go ahead.
Brother Knight, the article, and this is for our listening audience, because we'll be talking about this during the course of the program. It's in Al Jazeera, September the 18th issue. But if you go on the website, you'll see it on the Al Jazeera website. The danger of depoliticizing Black Power activism. And you kind of unearth some things here that's kind of interesting coming from a brother of your bracket. I don't know what they consider that age bracket in the UK. I know they got different names here in the United States, and Richard knows them better than me.
Hey, look.
But listen, that in the second sentence of this article, let me read this to you because I want you to kind of open this can up for us here. It says, although often ignored ideologically, the iconography of Black Power continues to be circulated in popular culture without a thorough engagement with the politics that led to its creation. Let talk about that, because that's going to open up this subject. Talk about that from how you wrote this and how you meant that.
Well, the idea of this article came about when I was watching the Black Lives Matter movements that were happening this summer. And I was seeing a lot of positive action being taken by people, but it was missing something. And I would see all of these pictures all over social media and all over the TV of people where, you know, rocking their afros and putting the, you know, their fist in the air and taking pictures of Angela Davis. And when I was looking at what these same people were actually saying at these Black Lives Matter marches, I was thinking that's not really matching with the image that you're giving off. And I started thinking about people like Angela Davis specifically, and about the way that she's really been marketed for the mainstream audience. So people recognize her, they know her name, they can have her on Vogue magazine, but they never talk about her politics. And this is something that happens with Black radicals all the time. If you look at Claudia Jones in Britain, she was instrumental in founding the Notting Hill Carnival. And in the UK, whenever it's Black History Month, which it is right now, we always hear Claudia Jones's name out there in the public, but no one actually knows that she was a communist. She was anti-imperialist. She was, you know, anti-capitalist. No one ever talks about these ideas. So I really wanted to write this article to get people to think deeper about their affection for some of these Black radical figures and their affection for the Black Power movement, and to get people to think about the ideology behind these characters, the ideology behind these movements, because that's so important.
Well, let me throw this out there and get your opinion on it. I think that the way these things are talked about in popular media, as you wrote, the iconography of it, I think it kind of plays to capitalism, where they can make money off these movements. And it's really geared not to have, especially our young people, start looking at what you consider the politics of what those people were trying to do. I think that's the whole thing in a nutshell, is to get our young people to pursue these things in a direction that really won't mean too much. You got young people walking around, even whites walking around with their fists in the air and things of that nature, but they really have no clue to what black folks were talking about at that time, or they don't want to know, and some of our young people and older people don't really know. So I think this is a excellent article that you've written to kind of get our people to really start analyzing what some of the movers and shakers in that movement was talking about, especially when you start talking about dealing in politics. Because you, in I think the third paragraph, you wrote that as frequently expressed in the organizational newspapers, the Black Power Black Power movement believed in black self-defense, black reliance, and black determination. The organization placed itself in opposition to white imperialism and capitalism. So if you're looking at an organization that was based in black self-reliance, black self-defense, and black determination, it's only natural that you're going to start talking about the politics of it all, controlling our communities, community control of police, community control of economics. These things go hand in hand, as far as I'm concerned. Give me your opinion, and I'll pass the mic to Brother Richard.
Well, yeah, I completely agree, and I think whilst I fully support the Black Lives Matter movement, the only real politics that I was hearing coming out of the movement in America was about defunding the police. And if you look at Britain, the political message was decolonize the curriculum. And whilst both of those are good ideas in their in their, you know, own regard, I think there is a need for the young generation today to explore some of the bigger ideologies and to just broaden their mind when they're thinking about the root of our problems. And I think all of this comes down to education. It's about young people reading books like The Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James, reading books like Destroy This Temple, and really understanding the nature of Black radical resistance, understanding race, gender, and class, and intersectionalism. And you were saying at the beginning of your question that a lot of young people don't engage with this. And I think sometimes we as young people need to take the responsibility ourselves. We need to ask ourselves, you know, are we going to wait to be spoon-fed this information, or are we going to try and teach ourselves? I mean, books are readily available. There are many podcasts, many YouTube shows out there that you can learn all of this information. So I think sometimes it's about the individual taking, you know, that impetus to go and teach themselves and not just waiting for other people to, you know, spoon feed it to them.
Yeah, as I was going through the article and the other articles that you wrote, there's a couple of things that I guess framing and that stands out to the points that you're making. And as centering this into the Black Lives Movement and this generation, I'll say the generation, your generation, the one before you, the question of, since we are in a new medium format, called it social media, right? Compared to when the Black Power, you know, and the Black Panthers, it was the television, was the medium and information outlet that they utilized to communicate. But the entertainers today, it seems like, because I didn't know who they were, Syria and Teyana Taylor, you make reference to them because they are imagery, they iconic, taking the imagery of the Black Panthers. My question, I wanted to get one part of it is in relationship to utilizing Black Black Lives Movement, and then how entertainers are utilizing their images to help shape, and I'm going to add, help propagandize the not going looking at the radical tradition of the Black Panther movement of the 60s. Would you agree that the entertainers are also complicit and not at least directing or advocating that this generation look at the Black radical tradition compared to look at the imagery and just emulate that?
Well, I think you've got some entertainers like Akala, who's a rapper and author here in Britain, who does a great job of getting this information out there. But in terms of Ciara and Tiana Taylor, who I wrote about in the article, whilst I was disappointed with their failure to really engage with the ideology, I do sympathize with them in a sense, and all entertainers in that regard, because I feel they are in an industry where if they do use their voice, they will be, you know, they'll be castigated for it. They may not get, you know, these book deals, record deals, whatever. So I feel they were in a tricky situation. And I think even just posting those images, they're doing their bit. But I think sometimes we need brave people to really take that forefront and take the movement further. So you had people like John Boyega, who was very vocal this summer during the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think if you have more people like him stepping out and being brave in that sense, I think you will see more entertainers being willing to talk about politics. I mean, you had Dolly Parton just a few weeks ago saying that she supported the Black Lives Matter movement. And that would have been unthinkable just a few months ago. So there is this turning of the tide that's happening at the moment. And I think hopefully in the future, we will see more artists being braver to speak out.
See, I want to engage this as a dialogue, because in questioning and knowing that you know, it's not just about the Black Lives movement itself and what is this doing, but just where we are in history. Because you make another point in the article, which I don't find interesting. Like, but let's match that up with the entertainers when you make reference that, I mean, in Britain, how the British government was using Angela Davis' image to deal with this counter-radicalism. So here we have a political moment in history where even the government is utilizing the imagery of coming out of the radical tradition. That seems like it reinforces what the imagery that the entertainers, the majority, and whether it's because they're, you know, they're looking at in relationship to their personal self-interest, especially with this new medium, you know, that they can be able to get a million likes or a million views doing their talent and, you know, expressing their talent, that the government itself, who wouldn't want the present generation to be exploring the radical tradition of the 60s from a political analysis. So don't you see that do you agree that they would be kind of supporting what the government is doing also? And that's, I mean, they're not looking at just Britain, because we see it happening here in the U.S. where they're utilizing you would never have heard as often as you hear now white supremacy, like vocalizing it by establishment orders. Do you see, as you're exploring the tradition coming from the perspective of England, that the government is also utilizing this here, which you call it iconery, to assist in curtailing this exploration of the Black radical tradition?
I think if you look back throughout Black radical history, this is nothing new. If you look at the British Black Panthers, back in the 70s, they had Special Branch, they had the Home Office, all of these state apparatus working against their ideology. And I think when you look at the British government today, they're doing the same thing, but in a new way. And the fact that they can have a picture of Angela Davis on an Instagram page that's a part of their Prevent De-Radicalization program just epitomizes capitalism at its best. If you can't beat them, sell them. And I think that's what they've gone with. And I don't think that artists like Ciara and Teyana Taylor are necessarily knowingly supporting the destruction or the erasure of the Black radical tradition. But like you said earlier, I think they're complicit in it. But I think government throughout history have always tried to undermine Black power, Black radicalism, and tried to cover this history. And the reason that it's not in the curriculum is because of that same reason. They don't want people to be exposed to these ideas.
And that's what raises the question for me. And again, it's just for a dialogue, because now we're kind of focusing, and what you did in the article and what you're doing in your whole exploration of the, what you call the social, you know, the social history exploration that you've been going on in Britain, looking at that over, like, which I was fascinated as I, you know, started reading about it, because I have to say it was a blank for me as far as the whether we and I'll do it like this. You had did one article where you were exploring the Race Today Collective and how that came into being. Could you share, your understanding as you explore that, like how those young people, and can we say they were young at the time, dealt with the questions that entertainers and Black Lives Matter organizers are supposed to be dealing with now. I think that would be that historical comparison, especially from the British perspective, might be helpful to us in understanding the point that you're making.
Yeah, well, I think when you're talking about Black power in Britain, there's no event that encapsulates that ideology better than the Mangrove Nine trial, which is the trial that I've been researching for this past year. And for your listeners who don't know about the trial, it was a trial of nine activists who were marching in defense of this restaurant called the Mangrove Restaurant, which was in Ladbroke Grove of Notting Hill. And it had been consistently raided by police, and eventually the Black community in that area organized a march in its defense. And when you look at the Mangrove Nine and everything that they went through, so they spent 55 days at the Old Bailey, and they were supported, some of the members of the Nine were British Black Panthers. So back then they were fighting against police brutality. They were campaigning against capitalism. They were speaking out against imperialism. And these are issues that we're facing today. And especially the Mangrove Nine, the kind of repression they went against when it came to the police. I mean, they were charged with riot and affray. And they were acquitted of those charges. But the same issues that they were facing back then are issues that we're facing today. And whilst we've got to commend them for, you know, their bravery in fighting against all of this, I think we have to ask ourselves, how have we ended up in a situation where we're reliving history again? We're going through the same struggles, all of this. And you mentioned the Race Today Collective. And the Race Today Collective were a collective out of a magazine called Race Today. And they would publish a lot of stories about Black issues. And this came under the umbrella of political Blackness. So this is the idea that no matter your color, you could come together as a collective. And with the Race Today Collective, they really foregrounded everything that they did within the community. They truly believed in this Jamesian idea of bringing your journalism into the community and getting people to speak for themselves rather than just simply reporting on them. And the Race Today Collective were instrumental in a lot of campaigns, especially with the Bengali community, especially with squatters' rights, especially when speaking out against Black repression by the police. So I think these characters were iconic in Black British history, not only for what they did, but for what they stood for.
And you know, Elliot, what I'm wondering, and when what Brother Knight raises, when we're looking at this moment with the Black Lives Matter and journalism, would you say that the journalism today is speaking, you know, letting the community speak compared to, I have to say my bias is that I'm not sure whether the Black Lives Matter is actually organizing more than it has been more of a general, I'll call it propaganda campaign. And, you know, but would you say that do you see that, you know, and I'm doing this as a shift just, you know, to so that you can get back in. But do you see that the journalism is speaking from the perspective of the community and as Brother Knight brought up?
No, wait a minute. You asked me that, Richard?
Yeah. Because as a transition, you know, back to you, you know.
Well,
because that's...
Well, in fact, I wanted to ask Brother Knight his opinion, being a young brother dealing with this issue and a journalist at that, writing for top worldwide publications. And I like that Brother Knight is dealing with history and considers himself an oral historian. Because when you mentioned, Brother Knight, about reliving history again, let's turn the clock back, because I think it's a danger for our people if we don't use history as a barometer or yardstick, that we'll be making serious errors again and again. And that's for anybody, but I'm talking about our people in particular. If you look at the NAACP, for example, when it was formed, W.B. Du Bois was one of the main characters involved, and it was other folks involved also. And at that time, W.B. Du Bois was 25, 26, 27, Richard, you clear me up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was young at the time. And the other people that got involved, we find out later on in history, Joel Spingarn and others, was working with the United States government. The organization itself wanted to monitor activities of black people under the guise of assisting black people, because it did assist black people in certain areas, Scottsboro Boys and others. But the organization itself was a monitoring device for black behavior. W.B. Du Bois even basically admitted that himself years later when he wrote the book, the title escapes me, Richard.
Is that Dusk of Dawn?
Yeah, The Dusk of Dawn, I'm sorry. When he talked about his experiences with the organization. So when we see an organization now that has been formed, Brother Knight, the Black Lives Matter Movement for Black Lives, that millions, hundreds of millions of dollars at this point, tens of maybe close to hundreds of millions of dollars have flowed into this organization by other people. These hundreds of millions haven't flown into this organization by black or grassroots black organizations. It has been pumped into these organizations by other folks. Do some of our folks realize the danger and other people controlling the narrative of a quote unquote radical or freedom fighting organization? Is there a danger in that from your historical perspective? And how do you get that message across to other younger people that seem to be enthused by seeing organizations like this, but might not realize the danger behind it, so to speak?
Yes, well, as I was watching the Black Lives Matter movement take place this summer, I was questioning its real radical roots based on its popular appeal. I mean, I think when you have companies like Disney or Virgin or all of these major companies and corporations supporting the Black Lives Matter movement and posting about it, you have to ask yourself, have you gone far enough? And I think one of the failures with the BLM movement is, I'll speak for the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK, is we're not seeing any literature being produced. You need that literature that's speaking to people at the grassroots. You need to have organizers who are organizing stuff at the grassroots level. You can't just be relying on media personalities saying Black Lives Matter. You can't just rely on a social media campaign, because all of that is going to die eventually. And I think a problem with similar movements that take place today is they're very reactive and they're not proactive. If you look at the Race Today Collective, if you look at Black Unity and Freedom Party, the British Black Panther movement, they all had newspapers that were speaking to the people. So you had Black Voice that was speaking to people in London. You had Race Today, for example, which was very popular, especially in Brixton. We're not seeing that same literature being produced. Now, okay, we're living in a digital world, but there's no reason why we can't have podcasts being made. We can't have YouTube content being made. Just something to get people thinking about these ideas for more than just 6 weeks and a year. Because those ideas aren't going to stay in people's mind. You have to go further. You have to keep the momentum going. You have to make sure that this is a movement and not just a moment.
And to that, the point that you're making, or emphasizing the point that you're making, is the political education. Because it seems now, because of the expansiveness of social media, that, as you mentioned, it's continuous reactionary. Like, it requires something to happen to somebody to perpetuate some engagement that provides some kind of imagery, which is media attention, whether it's by Twitter or Facebook or these other mediums, to have people talking about it. But they're no more informed of the broader context than the narrow issue that it speaks to. And if I may, Elliot, and to you, Brenda, the question that came to my mind is there, as Black Lives Matter has been dealing with it, and I don't mean to bring up Black Lives Matter as like it's something, because it's just the moment in history that we have to utilize, but it seems like they have a very broad expanse of image. But is there in England because of the continuation of, you say, the police engagement, is there like a, here they have a police union. Is there like a police union that is tied politically to the government in some way, in relationship, in some kind of way? Does that exist in England?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
Is there a police union amongst the police, a mechanism that, a political mechanism that is supportive of police action in England? And like they have a police union here. I was curious.
That's not something that I've come across. So I probably wouldn't be the best person to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. It's just a thought that I had, question I had, I wanted to know about.
Yeah, Brother Knight, the article you wrote about the history of state surveillance in Black communities, Black Britain, it says that there is a long racist history of state surveillance of Black communities. And you talk about the secret documents that was unearthed, talking about the steps that was taken by the British government to control Black power mobilization. That kind of relates to the comment or question that I raised earlier, because if we look at our experiences, and even though you're in England and we're here, when you talk about Western governments, collaborations with one another to influence and control behaviors of Black bodies, be it in the diaspora or the continent, they network on how to do this. So when you see movements arise, and you made the comment earlier, if you can't beat them, capitalize on them, or something like that. You made a reference to a little saying that they use. you know, if they see these movements arising, European governments and people in government have a way of cultivating ways to control these movements. When you talk about the Panthers and some of the what they consider radical movements in the 60s, they used an iron fist tactic, J. Edgar Hoover and others, to smash these organizations, kill the quote-unquote leaders, and jail the others for the rest of their, some of the people of the freedom struggles are still in prison. So I think it's a different strategy now that they're trying to adopt and use, where they use these movements to try to control young minds and especially to throw other things in the mix that have nothing to do with black independence or black sovereignty. Give me your opinion on that, Brother Knight.
Yeah, well, I think if you look historically at what was happening in the 70s, both in America and in Britain, you have governments who were trying to, they were trying to get in within the movement and cause disunity. And I've got to credit two historians, so Robin Bunce and Paul Field, who got those files from Special Branch declassified. And those files were really eye-opening for me, especially seeing just how meticulous and calculated this all was. So you had
I don't want to cut you, Brother Knight. Now, you said how meticulous and calculated the government did and trying to strategize this you're talking about?
Yes. For example, if you look at the Mangrove 9 trial, before the march was even organized, the police had, I think it was something like 700 policemen turn up to this local community demonstration, and there was only 150 demonstrators. And it later came out in court that they had people assigned to take photographs. They had chief superintendents all over the place. So they knew what they were doing. And by selecting those nine, the Mangrove 9, the reason they were selected is because these were people who were seen as leaders within the community. These were people that the police saw as being threats and as being the centers of the movement. So when they turned up on that march, they knew what they were doing. And this is something you see throughout the history of Black radicalism in America and also here in Britain. I think when we look at the dangers that are faced by the movements of today is about having these seemingly friendly corporations being so involved in the movement and being so supportive of it that you have to ask yourself, what is their agenda?
Okay.
And I think you have some people today who want to be seen as an activist and want to frame themselves as this radical individual, but actually their ideas aren't that radical. They're doing it more for the ego rather than for the movement. And I think that is the biggest danger today.
Okay. We're in conversation this evening with London-based journalist and oral historian Ryan Knight. The article that we're discussing, and including a few of his other articles, is the article that was in Al Jazeera this week, The Danger of Depoliticizing the Black Power Activism. You can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. I might take a call or two before we go to the break in a few minutes. Brother Knight, when you're talking about our people being involved in the ideological understanding of those organizations that were started, here, and now I don't know what's going on, and you can familiarize our audience with what's going on in Britain, but here in the United States, they have several black independent parties that have risen up. In the state of Maryland, UGMA's People's Progress Party, here in Pennsylvania, Brother Khalid Rahim's, the New African People's Party, and other areas in Missouri, the Universal African People's Organization, the Black is Back Coalition, down in Louisiana, the Black Coffee Party. It's black parties that have risen up in the same mold as the Panthers to organize communities to take political control of their communities. Talk about that in relation to your article, and is anything like that going on in Britain?
I think in Britain you're seeing a lot more activity, especially on campuses, around the issue of decolonizing the curriculum. And so, for example, this summer, a group of five students, including me, formed the Unlearn Collective. And we as a collective were pressuring our university to speak out against racism. So not just be anti-racist, but to be fervent on, you know, what they accept and what they don't, because at our university we had issues, race scandals pop up, and the university seemed not to know what to do. They didn't really have a set of guidelines for what they stood for. And that's something we really pressured them on, and also this idea of broadening the curriculum. So I would say the movement in Britain, we're not seeing as many groups form as maybe in America, but we are seeing a lot of the academic community speaking out and trying to tackle racism from the root of it, education.
Okay. The you talked about the historical lens of the activism. Let me do this, because we're going to break in about 5 or 6 minutes at the top of the hour. Let me take a call or two. Let's go to Maryland. I think we got representative. Gina Cooper. Hello.
Hey, peace, brother. This is Brother Brandon. Can you hear me?
Oh boy, yeah, Brother Brandon, I hear you, but the connection is really bad.
All right, hold on. Let me try to move around. Let me try to move in a better position a bit. Does this help?
No, it's really it's a terrible connection.
Damn, not that I had a good, I was in a good area. I'm going to try to move at a different part.
Are you on a speakerphone?
Yeah, but I'm using my mobile device or my computer.
Yeah, if you can get on a line, that would be better, because it's a bad connection this way.
I'll just hang up and call in, man, on my phone.
Good. All right.
All right, I'm calling.
All right. Yeah, this is what we'll do. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation, bring some of the callers in. You can get involved, too, in the conversation with our guests by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with, wait a minute. Let's, I think our call is back. Let's try him again.
Can you hear me, brother?
I hear you now.
All right, yeah, great. So this Brother Brandon, Eugene of People's Progress Party.
How are you, sir?
I was listening in, and I was really excited that I had the chance to clean up my house, get everything in order, but more importantly, be like, okay, yes, I made a call. Now I know for sure that I can put this on my personal schedule, because I'm sharing the schedule out with everyone. But pertaining to the conversation, I think, you know, the brother offered some insight, and as well as you, as you, Brother Richard and Brother Elliot, about particularly the Black Lives Matter, the agitation propaganda that's being done on media and the mobilization, but the concerted efforts to organize community to win power back to the community, independent power, that's kind of absent, and the ball and chain relationship between Black Lives Matter and the community has always been a Democratic Party and a nonprofit industrial complex. So I think that's something that is noteworthy and very considered as well. And it's not to diminish the idea of putting out that message. It's to be able to be honest about the relationship that poor and Black working class people that Black Lives Matter speak to, or that the base that they wish to reach, has to be addressed, because we cannot overthrow the slave master, but still expect the slave to stay on the plantation. I'm just glad that the discussion has happened, and I'm very excited to hear from, you know, the brother from Britain, and I'm just humbled just to be able to reach you guys and be a caller in, as opposed to just being someone who's speaking as a guest.
Well, stay on. Stay with us, Brother Brandon.
Okay.
Brother Knight, this is one of the activists here in the States, Ed, with the UGMA People's Progress Party, an independent black political party that's been organizing in Maryland, had several conventions to organize people to get involved, to take political control of their communities, similar to the article that you wrote where this consciousness needs to be raised again. I guess you heard Brother Brandon, some of his concerns about some of these popular organizations now. Any comments or anything in reference to that?
Yeah, especially in reference to his comment about the Democrat Party, I think it's so important that all of these movements that are springing up don't get too tied into party politics. Because at the end of the day, if you look at the history of the Democrat Party and the history of the Republican Party, they've both been complicit in furthering racism, furthering this systemic inequality. And it's the same here in Britain with the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. So I don't think party politics is going to help any of these movements at all. And I think when we're looking at these movements spurring up, I think we also need to center the ideologies in class struggle, because we can't look at racism on its own. We have to look at how it intersects with classism, how it intersects with ideas of sexism. And I think once you look at these broad ideas in their intersections, I think that's when you can come up with creative solutions for moving ahead.
Brother Brandon?
I think you made some interesting point. And as an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-sexist, anti-colonialist, and anti-racist party particularly, you know, we look forward to building along the principles of understanding that it's about community control of the resources that the 1%, or should we say the ruling capitalist ruling class, has. So with the class analysis being correct, there also has to be a framework that black workers are not uniting under the "we are all workers" or "we are all one," because when we have that conversation, there's that undertone or that underlining of, okay, we are all in the same boat, but the workers, the black workers, tend to be the ones at the bottom of that boat. And that's something we don't advocate for, nor is it something that we will say unite for the sake of uniting around class, because when we do that, we also advocate for the responsibility that when it comes to labor movement, any kind of struggle that is going to hurt the capitalist, imperialist, industrial complexes that are built around oppression of African people is always us being put to the side, or if not, being used as a facade or masquerading in front of popular struggle, as you mentioned, but only to reap little to no benefits. So it is important to be able to recognize the class question and not to be abandoned, not to abandon that at all. But we have to realize, too, as a colonized proletarian and the most oppressed in this nation, along with the indigenous and native folks that falls in, we can no longer use class as the frameworks to be able to say we're all oppressed, we're all in the same category, when that isn't necessarily true. When we understand that it's black workers that's getting shot down in the street at a higher rate, there's also black women that's being oppressed. And I'll just make a short example as far as COVID-19 and what we're dealing with. Some of the undertones or the mis-messaging, I'm not going to say mix, I'm saying mis-messaging, is that women are going to be the most, you know, black women particularly, because if they have to stay home with children, husband, wife, boyfriend, or however, they're the ones who's more likely are going to catch hell, because they're not going to be able to get the adequate health care that they wasn't getting before COVID-19. So when we talk about class and struggles, for that matter, we as an independent black worker political party have to put it in frameworks that some of the most valuable members that come from our community will be the first one to be oppressed and the first one to, you know, to lose, and the last one to be able to receive attention. Because we talk about triple layered oppression when we look at the layers of patriarchy, colonialism, capitalism, and also imperialism as well, when we say whose right gets protected. So when we're building that, we have to be mindful that if the black working class, particularly in that community, is to be supported first, for that matter. We now know that the most oppressed of all groups are able to advocate for themselves for self-determination, not just on the lines of we're all in the same category, but we're able to dismantle a system that uses sexism, that uses racism, that uses ableism in all kinds of forms to divide us, just simply because they know that, hey, you don't want to end up like that brother on the other side of the street who we strung out, and you don't want to end up like that sister who can barely pay her bills, but she belongs to a community that is, you know, economically underdeveloped and also systemically, structurally, and institutionally, you know, oppressed.
Brother Brandon, I want to thank you for your contribution, man, and I'll be in touch. Before I let you go, Brother Knight, anything you want to raise to Brother Brandon before I let him go and we'll break for commercial?
Yes, I wanted to say I agree with the sentiments of what he says, and I don't want to get misquoted here. When I talk about rooting it in class politics, I don't mean looking at class on its own. And this is why I stress the term intersectionality. And I urge all of your listeners to look up Claudia Jones, Selma James, and Angela Davis' work on triple oppression. So I think whilst we can bring class into our discussions, we've also got to recognize the unique perspective that people are coming to the table at. So if you look at Black women, like you mentioned, Black women come at this with, you know, double the oppression that Black men even get. And I think there's a responsibility for men, a responsibility for white allies to address these faults. So to address sexism, to address racism, but without losing the essence of intersectionality and where all of these plights come together.
And before you go to the you know, break, Elliot, the question I want to raise with Brother Knight, because you had mentioned earlier that your activism campaign in relationship to the curriculum, based off of what Brother Walker raised, is that those issues, intersectionality, race, class, gender, are they being addressed in the curriculum? And that's what they're not being addressed, and that's what y'all are organizing around? Or is it more that that as y'all looking at the curriculum, especially at the university level, that has to be inputted, you know, for those who are going through these different programs? Is that being addressed in the curriculum?
No, I wouldn't say it is. I would say whenever there's been discussions around racism and sexism, classism is very rarely discussed. It's very rarely discussed in our curriculum. But when we were forming the Unlearn Collective, a big motivator for us was also looking at the boardrooms at our university, looking at who are in those senior positions, as well as looking at who's on our reading list. So I think when you're looking at decolonizing the curriculum in the British context, it covers a whole range of ideas. Ranging from the makeup of the staff, ranging from the political messages behind what we're taught. I mean, when we're taught about Britain's imperial history, we're taught it in a very subjective way. So the curriculum tends to frame it around this idea of Britain going to the, you know, global south and giving them education and, you know, cleanliness and all of this, when in reality, that's not the truth. Britain went out to all of these countries to gain capital. So our big movement with decolonizing the curriculum was more at looking at the silences within our curriculum and looking at the political messages that are implicit within them.
We're going to take a brief break. Brother Brandon, thanks for calling, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks. Y'all take care. Have a good one.
All right, Pete. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can join the conversation. By dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll have our guest on for a little while longer because I know it's a late hour over there in Britain, isn't it, Brother Knight?
Yes, it is, but it's all right.
All right, we're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, like I said, we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. 3-2. We're in conversation with London-based journalist, oral historian, Brother Brandon Knight. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Commits You Black family, to join your interconnected Commits You Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
That this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda. Thank you.
We have a message to the black man. Because the black man today is a man who has been made now almost into a laughing stock. Nobody takes the black man serious. We are just used to be somebody's tool. We are the sportsmen. We're the singers and the dancers. And we're also labeled as the pimps and the criminals and the drug dealers and the killers and the vagabonds of society. We're the bogeymen of British society and other Western systems. And we want to dispel that lie and destroy those myths and put the black man back on the map where we belong. Who is the black man? The black man is the original man. If it wasn't for the black man, no other men could be on this planet. We are the fathers of humanity. We gave birth to all of you.
Watchman on the wall. You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchman for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend?
You can't do nothing for me. See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us.
Yeah.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:18 here in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in conversation tonight with London-based journalist, oral historian, Brian Knight. The article that we're discussing is an article that he had in Al Jazeera, The Danger of Depoliticizing Black Power Activism, along with some of his other articles and related topics. And you can get involved in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Brother Brandon. I mean, your Brother Brian, I'm sorry. Brother Brian, are you there?
Yep, here.
Brother Brian, before we left for commercial and you was talking to Brother Brandon from the Ujima People's Progress Party, we were talking about some of the similarities of what the government was doing to try to smash movements of our people in Britain. We see from a historical perspective that when folks like Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael at the time, and Malcolm came to Britain, that some of these movements were watched highly, and some of the men were banned from coming back once they came one time. Let our folks know about some of the repercussions of those movements. Here in the States, some of the people that were involved in those movements, such as Malcolm and others, were murdered by the government or government conspiracies. A lot of the activists, both in the Panthers movement, Black Power movement, SNCC, several of the different organizations that were fighting against imperialism and capitalism and racism of this government, were jailed, murdered, some still behind bars to this present day, freedom fighters. Was it the same in Britain as far as people that were involved? Are they still behind bars now? What was the repercussions of some of the people that got involved in these movements, the murders and things like that? Was it the same on both continents, or what happened in England to some of our activists?
I would say over here in Britain, it wasn't quite as overtly violent. But one of the ways that the state apparatus was used in order to silence a lot of these Black Power activists was by giving them suspended sentences. So they would be put on trial, often for publishing literature that the state didn't like or engaging in demonstrations. And instead of actually sending them to prison, so I'll give you context. So there were activists like Michael X here in Britain, who after his Reading trial, which I think was in 1968, after that trial, he ended up gaining huge popularity and fame within the Black community. And the state started realizing that every time that they put one of these Black Power activists on trial and end up arresting them, they end up leaving with a bigger following than they did when they went into the trial. So they started giving people suspended sentences, that way silencing them from further engagement in these activities and also stopping them from gaining further traction. So I would say that's a key way that Black Power activists were silenced. But like all things in Britain, it's done in a very, very subtle way. So the racism in Britain is not as overt as in America. It's done in an insidious way. And we've seen this throughout history, even the way that Black people are dealt with in the UK, it's never overt. It's always done with this, yeah, like I said, insidious way. But I would say the biggest price that a lot of these activists paid was by personal trauma. And this is something I write about in the Al Jazeera piece. A lot of the activists that I've interviewed on my Telefriend YouTube show have spoken to me about the way that they have been affected by it emotionally, mentally, and even today, a lot of them don't like talking about it because they really went through hell during that period. And when I was writing my piece on the danger of depoliticizing Black Power, it was also about the dangers of dehumanizing these activists. They, at the end of the day, they're human just like everyone else. And whilst we call them heroes, they've had to sacrifice a lot. And a lot of them are still traumatized by everything that they went through, be it violence from the police, be it family trauma, be it the friendships that were lost during the movement. A lot of them were victims of the movement. So I would say, yeah, that's the biggest price that they had to pay.
When you said suspended sentences, what was it that so sentences conditioned on their release that they don't involve themselves into these activities? And how did that suspended sentences work?
Yeah, basically, they would be given partial freedom, but this stopped them from engaging in demonstration. This prevented them from publishing literature. So essentially, they were given freedom, but imprisoned by their voice. They weren't really allowed to speak out, otherwise it would have been a jail sentence. And this was a clever way by the state to, you know, stop the spread of Black Power, but also in a way that prevented them from you know, gaining huge media coverage. I mean, if you look at the Mangrove 9 trial, the amount of media coverage that it got was huge. If you look at Michael X, who he was involved in a lot of these trials, he gained the attention of people like John Lennon, and a lot of these famous white radicals were drawn to him. And the state didn't want this. The state didn't want this media attention going on the Black Power movement because they were trying to silence it and they were trying to stop it spread.
Okay. Richard.
Yeah, my kind of shifting to your oral history interests. You know, one, and you're focusing on the oral history surrounded around the political radical tradition as far as gathering that information. Is there a I'm gonna call it a movement, a interest around collecting by the community in general, oral history understanding as it relates to Black Britons, since Britain has a lot of immigrant population? Is there a oral history, or is this something that's kind of, you're kind of like one of a few?
Well, I would say there is more oral history that needs to be done. There is a lack of it, in my view. But the reason that I got involved in oral history as a profession, I guess, is because there was a lack of source material on this history. When I was looking at the British Black Panther movement, I couldn't find any of their literature. I couldn't find anything that was written about them. And the limited readings that were written was all done for the academic audience. And I started thinking, well, a lot of these activists are still with us. And, you know, they're great resources of information. And who best to speak to about this history than the people who have actually lived it? Because they can give you a unique insight into the realities of the movement and not look at it from, you know, a removed perspective. So I did it. I started it based on that. I really think in Britain, a lot more young people need to start collecting these oral history and oral history interviews. And they don't need to just be with famous individuals. They could be with your, you know, your grandmother, your mother, your father, your aunts, your uncle. Everyone has a history to tell. And history is always going to be subjective. And I think we need to just collect these everyday stories of what's happened in the past. And we have a lot of people who we're fortunate that they're still here with us, but no one's really making use of them as a resource. And that's what I try and do with my show.
Brother Brandon, before I take a couple of more callers, you just mentioned to Richard about the reason you became an oral historian, and that it wasn't much writing on that period. Now, I'm quite sure that people there wrote material. Is it that the material is not available? And I'm talking about even some of the activists that have written here in the States. Is that information monitored? Is it not available for some of our people there? Or explain to our audience that dynamic there, that a lot of these writings are not available.
So it's kind of a, there's kind of two problems in that. So A, we've got a lot of people who have a lot of their old newsletters, a lot of the minutes from their meetings that they just keep in their personal collection. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you have to reach out to them to access it. But the second problem we have is the information that has been donated to museums and archives isn't digitized, which makes it very hard to access. When I was doing my research, the beginning of it, I wasn't living in London. So that was that had a cost to it, trying to access this material. And also a lot of this material in the archives isn't organized. So you can take months just spent in the archives trying to find this information. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in digitizing this information and making it accessible, not only for the academic market, But, you know, for the grassroots audience, for, you know, for the everyday person who wants to read this information and learn about this history.
Richard, you know, we talk about here and some of our people being ignorant of what's going on. And when I say ignorant, I'm not talking about our people being less intelligent, but they don't have the information. Look at it when, you know, you hear Brother Brandon talking about our communities over there in England don't have access to certain informations. That shows us that the struggle really continues. I mean, wow.
And you know, it's interesting as you bring it up and it's aside, because when you're talking about digitizing, and I think you may know, you know, me being involved with a historical cemetery where we have documents and they're in bad shape, and trying to go through the process of taking those documents and digitizing, because, you know, when you're talking about information that goes back, and this is just maybe names and profiles of individuals that might go back to the 18th century. And when you have to do that on your own. So what I hear Brother Brandon raising the point that people donated work, and, you know, that is being set aside. And the concern is, unless, and I'm glad that even with the curriculum, the individuals that are involved, because they become the individuals that may have the interest to do that kind of work as they go through their academic studies and whatever, unless the community is able to put up the funds to have that kind of work done. Because not just the cost to access it, the cost to digitize is expensive also. So it has to be, has to be funded for that to be done, to be digitized and then categorized in that sense. But and the other point that when you said about people having it in their home, it reminds me of how even in Timbuktu now, all those historical records of Africans are in people's personal collections, that only a small number have been brought out by family members and then therefore digitized. The historical record that we carry in our personal lives is, you know, just something that it seems to be a coordination within our cultural matrix for right now that we have to address. So I'm glad that you're at least on that quest.
Let's go to 919 North Carolina. A question or comment for our guest? 919, are you there? Let's put them back on hold. You know, Brother Brandon, you talked about the need for some of this information. We got somebody on the line here that has a book that you might want to get your hands on, Brother Brian. The author of The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution and the Black Power Era. And the author is Professor Earl Henderson. He's with us from Detroit. Professor Henderson, how are you?
How you doing there, Brother Elliot? Can you hear me okay?
I hear you. I know you're listening to the conversation we're having with our guest, oral historian and London-based journalist, Brother Brandon Knight. Is a young brother doing a lot of good work over there in England, and talks about the dearth of material that he has in reference to our struggle over there in England and here. So, I know that you got a couple of questions. You might have some things that you want to impart to him.
Oh, yes, sir. And it's a pleasure to be with you, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And I hope I can send them the link to the free copy of the book that anyone can access. And I've been listening to him, and I really appreciate his piece he wrote in Al Jazeera, which I read. And just as I read it and listened to his comments tonight, I was just thinking about the Saturday Night Live last night with Megan Thee Stallion, and she came out and did her performance of Savage. But then in the background, that she put up the Black Power salute, and there were recitations from Malcolm, from Minister Malcolm, on the Saturday Night Live on the stage. I don't know if you all saw that.
No,
so it's just timely. Okay, so Brother's Al Jazeera piece is so timely in that sense too, because here she is, the famous icon Megan Thee Stallion, and she just held up the Black Power salute as this recitation of Malcolm, as she did Savage. But I wanted to ask Brother, Brother's piece too. It was one thing, just as a suggestion, Brother, when you talked about Angela Davis and the way you set that up, and I think you set it up very nicely. And then, but the case that made her her call celeb. The Soledad brothers, Rochelle McGee, who's one of the Soledad brothers, he's the longest held political prisoner in the United States. He's been in captivity since 1970, so that's 50 years. So the person, the call celeb, that made Angela Davis the call celeb, Rochelle McGee, a member of the Black Panther Party, is still in captivity today. So again, the brothers' piece is so timely. But I want to get to the question, though. Brother mentioned Trinidad. I'm sorry, Brother mentioned Claudia Jones, CLR James, and Michael X, and all of them are from Trinidad originally, and I think and I'm thinking about Michael X, who was hanged, and I know he did work with Hakeem Jamal, who helped create US Organization of the United States. So I'm thinking of the Trinidadian Brits in the UK, and then I'm thinking, Brother Brand, of the Stephen Lawrence killing and the impetus of the Jamaican Brits in the UK. And I wanted to ask you, to what extent is the Black struggle in the UK largely Jamaican and Trinidadian Brits struggling? That's one. And then the other is, would you say something about the relationship between Blacks and Indian Brits? Here, I mean Indians from the subcontinent, and in the struggle there, what is the relationship you'd say between Black Brits and Indian Brits? So one is about to what extent is there contributions from Jamaican and Trinidadian Brits that define the Black struggle in the UK. And then the other is, to what extent is there some type of association between Blacks in the UK and Indians in the UK with respect to Black liberation struggles there? So those are the two things. Now, I really enjoyed your piece in Al Jazeera. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you for that. And I'll start with your first point. I think when we look at Black British history in the UK, it is, as you rightly pointed out, it is largely a West Indian history, but that doesn't negate the African history of African Brits. So you had people like Sam Sage, who was a Nigerian activist, and he was a member of the Black Panthers in Britain. But I think what differentiated a lot of the Africans who were living in the UK during the 50s, 60s, 70s, compared to their West Indian counterparts, in my assessment, is that a lot of the African migrants came here for their education and tended to go back to African countries to take leadership positions at home. Whereas a lot of the West Indians came here and really created a new life for themselves in Britain. And like you said, the Trinidadians who came here, so Althea Jones Laquan, Darcus Howe, CLR James, Claudia Jones, all of these people, there is a radical Trinidadian tradition here in Britain, and you know, they've contributed a great deal to British history. But to your second point, around the relationship with Black Britons and the South Asian community, I would say in the 60s and 70s and even 80s, they coalesced around this idea of political Blackness. So they saw themselves as Black. If you asked a South Asian member, a South Asian person in Britain, you know, what are you? They would say, I'm Black. And this is this political definition where, you know, the white society sees us all as all the same. We're all facing this oppression, and it's better to come together and unite. And this is why in my Navarra Media piece for the Black Britannia series, I included the Asian youth movements, because it's such an important part of Black British history as well. Because if you look at Race Today, which was a Black radical news magazine, they help the Bengali community a lot, especially in East London. They worked with South Asian counterparts. In the British Black Panther movement, you had people like Marla Sen and Farouk Dondi, who were South Asians. So I would say that's a big difference compared to the Black Panther movement in America. Here in Britain, it was kind of, if you didn't fit the white stereotype, come and join. But after the late 80s and early 90s, you see this dissolution of the idea of political blackness. It was no longer popular. And this is, in my view, because funding started entering a lot of these radical groups. Mm. And once funding enters, that's when you see the divide start. Mm. And a lot of them started rushing to differentiate themselves and to, you know, compete against each other for funding. And today, when you talk about political blackness, it is not a popular idea amongst young black people. I happen to be in a minority who, you know, wishes we had something like that today, because I really think it worked effectively in the 70s. But young black people today do not want to hear about political blackness. And I see where they're coming from. But at the same time, when I look at how effective the Black Panther movement was in Britain, when I look at how effective the Race Today collective was by coalescing around this idea, I really wish we could do something similar today.
Well, I appreciate it. How do you explain the success of Akala? He seems to be he's very conscious. You mentioned him earlier today. Is it just a small part of some of that interest in political blackness?
So around your question with Akala, were you asking about his support for the ideology? Or could you repeat that? Sorry.
Is he an exception? Because you said there's no interest in it, but I associated him with political blackness. Or am I wrong in that?
I would say when you look at Akala's history, he really grew up with this black radical tradition that I'm talking about. So in his book, he talks about going to black supplementary schools. So I don't know his personal stance on it, but I do know that he talks a lot about coming from this radical tradition. And he engaged with a lot of these ideas growing up.
I see. Well, thank you very much for the article. It's very informative, too, and I appreciate it. I'm going to continue listening.
No, thank you.
Yes, Professor Henderson, if you I'll forward Brother Brian that link where he can get a copy of the book.
Oh, I so appreciate that. Thank you so much, Brother Elliot.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk soon.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think, Brother Brian, you'll enjoy reading that piece. I think Richard is up to...
Right, and I didn't want to mention Claudia because I said, well, maybe I shouldn't, you know. So I'm glad Professor Anderson did call in to clarify, because he does a great job in explaining the point that you made in relationship to Claudia Jones dealing with blackness and womenness and the communist or, you know, communist, like placing, centering that, you know. I think he did a very excellent job in being able to show how she had to pull that to get together to center it in blackness compared to just a class analysis of being a Marxist. So, yeah. And I ain't want to butcher it. So I'm letting you know, I ain't want to butcher it. you see, Brother Brian, we're very open in the exchange and the development of these not ideals, not necessarily just for the sense of the interview, but in the whole process of getting a better understanding, as Elliot said, so that we get to know, so that we won't be ignorant, and it helps us make better choices. And believe me, your article and the follow up helped me, because I didn't know that. In C.L.R. James School, the Boggs were a part of a working group with C.L.R. James. And the reason why it kind of struck me personally, because here in Philadelphia, they had a group called Brothers Only. And one of the members, elder members that was a part of it, he introduced me to the Boggs writings, you know, as far as in reading. So when I seen that I said, oh, you know, so that shows you how much, you know, we can continue to learn. and how our experiences, even if we go through them, we might not know how we're interconnected to other, the radical tradition without necessarily knowing that we are.
Yeah, Brother Brian, before I let you go, because I'm keeping you late, and I'm going to get you to tell the listening audience a little bit about your podcast, and maybe we can talk about that some off the air. You have a unique perspective, Brother Brian, because you said that you were born in Kenya, but maybe a lot of your growing up happened in London, I would assume, but your parents are from the continent, and you grew up in a diaspora of the continent, which is England. My upbringing is here in the U.S. Our struggles are very similar to what we're dealing with. But let me, it was an article that I read a couple of weeks ago in the African, and I just want your opinion on it, the African Report. And it talked about South Africa being a sophisticated failing state. Brother Brian, and I'm looking at this from the mental level. We see that after apartheid government and Mandela got out of jail and the ANC took over and things were supposed to be different for our people down there, and here 25 years later it's a similar situation. It could it's possibly worse, and our people is in semblance of control. But if you look at the institutions, the economics, even the political setup is still based on the oppressor. Is it necessary, in your opinion, and as a journalist, that if our people are talking about real liberation, it has to start in the mind first, that we have to alleviate ourselves of these things in order for our people to move forward in a real way, instead of having semblances of moving forward, and then when you turn around 5, 10, 20 years later, you're right back in the same situation and possibly worse. Talk about it from your perspective of the continent and in England.
Yeah, well, whenever I talk about the issues faced in Africa, I really think it's due to neglect of Pan-Africanism.
And wait a minute, say that. You broke up slightly, Brother Brian. Repeat that.
I believe that the problems that arise in Africa are due to a neglect of Pan-Africanism.
Okay.
And I say that because when you look at, okay, so let's deal with the trade issue, the economic issue. How comes the continent does so little, you know, intra-continental trading? And if you look at continents in the continent of Europe, if you look at Asia, they do so much trading internally, but we don't see that in Africa. And that's because African countries have come to regard themselves as competitors instead of really uniting as a bloc. And I was so pleased when I was seeing the developments of the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, because in my view, I really think that this this continental free trade agreement is one of the solutions that will end, you know, this state of Africa being the neglected continent on the global stage. But as well as that, I think you've got issues such as corruption that are going on in Africa. I mean, during this COVID-19 pandemic, how many of these African leaders and their counterparts have been using all of this COVID-19 money for their personal gain? And it's not just restricted to COVID-19. This happens time and time again. You have the leaders at the top who get into power with all of these revolutionary ideas for bringing Africa together and, you know, uplifting their country. But once they get into power, suddenly money is greater than ideas.
Mm.
But I don't want to fall into the trap of just saying Africa's problems is because of African leaders. No, this is also a problem with the West. the West has a certain way of framing Africa, and it's around this development idea. So in the UK, we have something called Comic Relief and Children in Need. And they'll host this event once a year where they're posting pictures of poor African children with flies around their face talking about how sad it is over there. Well, I've been to Africa. I was born in Kenya. I know that the reality is that you have a whole range of different people of different economic classes in Kenya and in Africa. It's not one homogenous block. And by framing Africa in this way, this negative portrayal, it leads to, you know, worse economic deals. It leads to, you know, certain prejudices being held against Africans and Africa as a continent. So I think when we talk about African development, we really need to deal with the leaders who are already in place in Africa, but also come up with radical ideas for how the global South interacts with the West. I really think that we need to rethink those relationships.
And if I may follow up on that, mm-hmm. do you see that the generation of this generation, your generation of Africans from the diaspora that is in Britain, are they more apt now to be advocating for the two aspects that you raised, you know, the Pan-African or the integrational aspect of African states, and also, you know, addressing, and rightfully so, the mixed message, but the corruption? Are the this generation of Africans that, you know, that is in Britain, or diaspora Africans in Britain, are they more apt to be speaking to that, even if there are in Britain itself?
Well, I would say based on my peers who I've spoken to, I don't hear them talking about these ideas enough. I don't really hear Pan-Africanism being debated properly. But I think with people like myself who have grown up for most of my life in Britain, sometimes they can feel a bit of a distance from our African root based on the immediate context that we're living in Britain. And, you know, I do think that that's the fault, and that's something that I've got to work to educate myself on and try and be a better rounded person. But no, amongst my age group, I really don't see these discussions being had.
Well, listen, you're a journalist or historian. You write for several large publications, and you're an example to folks of your generation and older generations. So I think by reading your materials, seeing your ideas, I think that'll influence a lot of people. And maybe if you're some of your generation, if you've been running into, is an influence, maybe you will help. And I know that you'll help. I'd put it that way. I know that you'll be an influence on them.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Brother Brian, before we leave, talk a little bit about your podcast. Maybe we can talk about some things, too. Maybe I can get some of the episodes on and put them on Time for an Awakening. But tell the listening audience a little bit about your podcast, some of the things that you cover, things of that nature.
Yes, so I have a podcast called Tell a Friend, which is a current affairs talk show. And I started the podcast in 2018, and it just started with me talking about issues going on in the Global South and issues that were interesting to me. But this year, the show's taken a drastic turn, and it's taken on an interview format. So far, I've had guests like Nikki Giovanni, I've had Benjamin Zephaniah, Jane Elliott, Denise Oliver Velez. So I've had a whole range of people come onto the show, and it's a long interview format. So I sit with them, I talk about their life, I talk about their work, and I talk about the pressing issues of the day. So we have the podcast, which is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and we also have the YouTube channel where you can visually watch the interview. And in my opinion, I think the YouTube experience is far better because, you know, you can tell a lot by people's body language, facial expressions. You get the whole experience.
Yeah, well, that's what I've been trying to convince Richard about. But
here we go.
Brother Brian, thanks for being with us, man. I'm going to be in touch with you. It's good to have some connections over there in England that can give our people some insight on what's going on. And hopefully you'll share some things with us. We'll post them on Time for an Awakening so our people can see what's going on. And I'll be in touch with you. Keep the line open.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's been an honor to be on here.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you, sir.
Take care now.
We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, for the time we got left, maybe we can take a few of these calls, Richard. Mm-hmm. And you can do that by joining us at 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Time for an Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back. It's time for an awakening. I want to thank our guest that was spent some time with us this evening, London-based journalist and oral historian Brian Knight. His article that was in Al Jazeera, The Danger of Depoliticizing the Black Power Activism. Interesting article, and he got other articles on there, so check him out. Happy to have him contribute to the program this evening. Richard, I know there's a few other things going on that we want to throw into the mix.
But, no.
Before we do that, your assessment of some of the things that Brother Knight was saying, and, take into account, he's a young brother. So, I mean, it's interesting to get his perspective and also his perspective on his peers, the perspective of what's going on in England among our people. It's interesting, and it lets us know that flame is still burning, whether you're talking about older people, younger people in the struggle. That flame has not went out, and it's going to continue to catch fire. But give me your opinion on some of the things.
The one thing that jumps out to me that's important in what he raised is the question of and of how effective the state has been, the Western state has been.
Yes.
And being able to disconnect as they say, the black radical of development, ideological development and organizational development at this point from the generation that Brother Brian represents. In mass now, and that's one thing, and I'm trying to keep in mind something else, and I might be reading this wrong. How much, and I raised it with the question around entertainment, but how much the we have to be careful in the symbolism of the era of Black Power in this moment when the Western state is utilizing these symbols to further ingratiate itself in co-opting a formidable resistance in this period, because obviously to it that these symbols have still, because and it came out in our discussion that the conditions, the police brutality condition in the Western world and in the major Western centers in England and in United States, the police oppression is still with us. Maybe we could say two generations later, and it is only really it's consolidating itself and adding these new tools, whether it be the tools of social media. And, you know, what briefly we kind of touched on, and he touched on in one of his articles about the mechanism of the surveillance state. These new tools in order to avert the development of, you know, this radical tradition. I think that that's another thing that comes out of our discussion, that the not only is the generational gap in exposing more young people in this generation to the tradition of an ideological understanding and a cultural understanding, and I have to say I keep right now I'm keeping Brother Henderson's understanding the importance of how much Black culture is involved in this, and here we're seeing these Black culture symbolism being used, but is it being used to help organize? And that's the other thing that came up out of our discussion in relationship to the globe, you know, at least amongst the Western world, and might be amongst the Southern Hemisphere too, that the Black Lives Matter brand has a global effect in the Western center, but does it have the organizing methodology as it relates to being close to the people on the ground and assisting to politically educate people at the grassroots level, and also to be able to politically organize at the grassroots level, compared to just being able to project issues at this point. And my last point would be the discussion, you know, which is important, of how the critique of the radical, radical was about capitalism, imperialism, and, you know, all its effect in relationship to race, where now there seems to be more an engagement of I'm gonna call it reform, whether you say to deal with anti-racism compared to anti-imperialism, economic inequality compared to the structural reality that capitalism fosters and maintains and continues to maintain a level of economic inequality. So, you know, these kind of points, by not being as perceived as openly developed in his generation, is something that we have to be concerned, not necessarily looking at his generation, but looking at the generation that comes after him. So those are the thoughts that came out of the discussion for me.
Yeah, and you know, especially that first point you made about the control of information that's put, you know, among our people over there, that they don't have access to certain informations, to certain, and I'm not talking about documents that 200 or 300 years old, or even ancient documents. What we're talking about is something that happened in the listening audience's lifetime, from the 70s, and they don't have access to, only in digital forms. I mean, wow. We got some challenges. There ain't nothing that we can't face. We didn't face a lot of challenges. But
And I have to say, Ellie, for me, you know, especially when you look at, and I've been projecting, those of us who are in our 50s and 60s that are still around, and relatively healthy and relatively have some economic mobility, and even if we haven't necessarily been actively involved in those periods, but are aware, empathize, sympathize, and recognize that it's necessary to create a better reality. We still have time to have influence and impact on Brother Brandon's generation, to assist them in being able to, you know, not just find their way, you know, or tell them what to do, but being real active resources for them, to assist in them formulating, and in that having some connection and building and learning this reality that we recognize has to be dealt with. You know, they project like a lot of us are sick and dying, but a lot of us aren't sick and dying. Mm-hmm. A lot of us are able to move around and are able to engage, but we still have to be studying, because the environment that the West is producing, the global world is producing, continues to change. And therefore we have to continue to learn how can we be of assistance. And I think that's where the continuous bright light of our resistance and struggle crafting a new reality, if it may be, or, you know, bringing up the contradictions is, you know, that we can be able to be assistance to them. But if we're at a distance, they have to find their way again. And that because the documents are not there, and, you know, but we have to be able to make ourselves accessible, having this kind of communication.
That's why I'm glad Professor Henderson called in, because I think his book in Brother Brian's hands will be a valuable tool in his toolbox, so to speak. So I'm going to make sure that he gets that link where he can have that information in his hands.
And we definitely need to, you know, get the information of what was going on in England for those of us who didn't know. And being able to, you know, assist in, you know, fostering that, you know, Pan-African, dealing with that Pan-African reality from a geopolitical perspective. We sit in a state that is actually, you know, also engaged in wrestling with the continent, and continue to be creating its destabilization, which is may not seem as much. I mean, we talk about AFRICOM, you know, all the time, but there's a lot of other things going on in relationship to, you know, the American state and the West. I mean, we hear about France, how much wealth it's been extracting out of the Francophone countries. You know, we hear, you know, about the ECOWAS countries and its relationship to Britain. So we can be able to be real advocates, even though we're not necessarily there, in relationship to foreign policy, and assisting to free up so Africa can do put real intra-state trade barriers, mechanisms together. So we have a role in that Pan-African experience that compared to just being isolated and focused just in our only in our American, you know, challenge, and that could be able to assist us, assist them, and assist us. I mean, that's been the vision for since our displacement. And we can continue to, you know, strengthen that strategic relationship, strategic alliance, but we have to be able to, you know, organize ourselves and provide that kind of foreign policy understanding with those in the Caribbean and those, you know, in England, you know, in order to assist those on the continent. That's our foreign policy initiative when we look at it from that perspective.
You know, and I'm glad Brother Brian is using an historical perspective, an historical lens when he's looking at these issues and then looking at other people, because when you use an historical perspective, especially dealing with Europeans, it really gives you a almost like a buoyancy, almost like somebody got a life raft when they're in the ocean so they don't drown. It kind of keeps your head above water so you can look at things from another lens, so to speak. One thing I want to throw in before I go to these calls. During the comedy show that was on, I think, Thursday night or whatever that was, I looked at some of it briefly. And Trump, no, I think the host, Chris Wallace, asked both of them, but I think he asked Trump first about these white extremist groups and condemning them. And he didn't condemn any. They were talking about the Proud. In fact, I think it was the host that mentioned the Proud Boys in particular. And he didn't, you know, try to act like he didn't know who they was. I think he told them stand up and stand down or whatever. And then when the other candidate, Biden, jumped in saying, oh, you won't condemn these people. So then he flipped the script and told him, well, why don't you condemn Antifa? Hmm. So Biden said to him, Antifa is not an extremist group. They're just an ideology. Now, let's look at that whole thing. I'm talking about two Europeans debating about their own brethren. Now, and this was a little over, it's almost a year anniversary, Richard, but it happened in August of last year. This is 2020. And this was 2019 when it broke. And let me share with just to refresh the audience, because Chris Wallace asking him to acknowledge. In fact, they asked heads of his officials about white supremacy, would he condemn it? You remember that a couple of weeks ago? Mm-hmm. Say that again?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, let me read this, and this is almost a 1 year. It happened in August of last year. It says, FBI ranking black identity extremists as a bigger threat than white supremacy hold on a second. As a bigger threat than Al-Qaeda and white supremacy, the black identity extremist was a bigger threat. Now, this broke. This was a leaked document that broke in August of last year. It says the FBI leaked FBI documents revealed that black identity extremists are now considered among the agency's top counterterrorism priorities. The 2018-2019 threat guidance documents describe black identity extremists as those who use forceful violence in violation of criminal law in response to perceived racism or injustice in American society. Now, that's what the document said, perceived racism. Now, all of a sudden, this year, they know it's racism. They know it's systematic. Last year, it was only perceived by some misconstrued blacks who they considered identity extremists. But now it's a known fact. Hmm. Now, either I'm crazy, or these folks are just, they think that you're a fool. Now, let me read from this unclassified document, Richard, with the government of the United States seal on it. Let me just read a couple of lines for our listening audience. Under the threat definition, black identity extremists use forceful violence in violation of criminal law in response to perceived racism or injustice in American society. Some do so in furtherance of establishing a separate black homeland or autonomous black social institutions, communities, or governing organizations within the USA. A desire for physical or psychological separation is typical among their political belief systems, which is sometimes formed around or include a belief in radical superiority or supremacy. Retaliation and retribution for perceived wrongdoings against African Americans has become an organizational driver for black identity extremists. Some black identity extremists desire separation from perceived oppression and other oppressive forces who are viewed as participants in this perceived unjust institutional system. This type of targeting has become a more obtainable goal for black identity extremists. Some still advocate for a separate homeland, while others advocate for starting a race war. Now, this is from an official document, Richard. Mm-hmm. It mentioned perceived wrongdoings and perceived racism several times in this official document. Like, that's what you believe, but that's not what we believe. You follow what I'm saying?
And you want a whole separate homeland.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I didn't even go into their definition of what a black identity extremist is. But for our listening audience, I'll read it again. Black identity extremists, furtherance of establishing a separate black homeland or autonomous black social institutions, communities, or governing organizations within the U.S. and a desire for physical or psychological separation is typical among their political belief systems, which is sometimes formed around or include a belief of radical superiority or supremacy, and retaliation or retribution for perceived wrongdoing against African Americans. Let me read this other paragraph and then I'll go to a couple of callers. The Counterterrorism Division will continue to focus on identifying national trends and federal crimes committed by black identity extremists to lower the intended threat impact of black identity extremists. The FBI expects field office work could mitigate and lower the national level of the extreme threat. Field office work. Okay, let's keep that in mind, Richard. Mm-hmm. Maintenance of state and local partnerships combined with source development could result in detection and prevention of black identity extremists. Wait a minute. You know, white folks love to use all types of coded language. Let's come on. Our listening audience is critical thinkers. Let me read this again, Richard. Maintenance of state and local partnerships combined with source development could result in detection and prevention of black identity extremists. Richard, help me. What's that mean? I mean, listen, you know I'm being facetious.
Oh, no.
What does that mean?
It's just interesting what it generates for me anyway.
Now let me finish. Just keep that in mind and our listening audience. If they want to comment on these things, they can. Or if they want to talk about the comedy show that was on, they can do that too. I ain't even focusing in on that bull crap. But the vetting, hold on. It is challenging to get sources into black identity extremist groups due to their security measures these groups employ. The vetting process and time investment to gain access to leadership in black identity extremist groups is very lengthy. The use of undercover employees and online covert employees in black identity extremist investigations could provide valuable intelligence to assist in mitigating these threats. The FBI HQ threat, mitigation strategy is called Iron Fist, to be implemented to mitigate the potential threat posed by the black identity extremist movement at the national level. Iron Fist will accomplish this by identifying actionable intelligence to directly support the initiation of FBI investigations and augment current efforts directed against black identity extremists. So, wait a minute. Along with some of the other things employed, this Iron Fist is going to be implemented, Richard. This is all from FBI. I'm going to send it to you. This is all from FBI documents. That you're the biggest threat and your perceived belief that you're being oppressed here is leading you to desire an autonomous black homeland, autonomous black social institutions, black communities, or governing organizations within the U.S. to desire physical or psychological separation is a typical political belief of black identity extremists.
That's a national security threat.
Oh, yes. And again, they're going to employ the maintenance of state and local partnerships combined with source development could result in detection and prevention of black identity extremist activities. Maintenance.
I have to say this, Elliot, because it ties to the discussion we were having and wanted to go back to the point that you raised as far as in the exchange they had the other night, because those groups that were being mentioned, they're not considered that, even though there's another FBI report where how the police department is being infiltrated by, you know, these here white, you know, groups and asking the president, you know, is there something, you know, to denounce, and you get, you know, the muffling of the mouth. But, you know, that aside and need to further develop it to where we were, you know, the concern I have is in relationship to the propaganda and the entertainment and members in the entertainment industry, especially now when we're talking about so many are pushing. When you said that government, you know, making connection with government sources.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the entertainers and entertainment industry projecting symbolisms, you know, iconic symbolisms that relates to that period when black, that again, when we're talking about that critical race theory, the whole thing about black liberation period, and asking for, whether it be about five states or whatever, that these symbolisms are being used in now, but they're tied to the Democratic Party or to get out the vote.
And not only that, Richard, but what we were talking about this evening. Now, this is me saying this. Somebody else might have a different opinion. But when it states here in this FBI document that, and I'll read it again, if I can hone in on it. Okay. Maintenance of state and local partnerships combined with source development could result in de- detection and prevention of black identity extremist activity. Wait a minute. State and local partnerships. You know, unless I'm mistaken, all you see now when you turn on your television is commercials on television for Black Lives Matter. If I turn on and watch an NBA or football game, it's commercialism with Black Lives Matter. All of a sudden, you matter. This your equality is. Come on. State and local partnerships. You know, I see a state and local partnership with Black Lives Matter. Maybe I'm wrong, Richard.
I mean, that's the other part of it.
Oh, okay. Well, this document says establishing the maintenance of state and local partnerships combined with source development. I don't know what that could entail. When you're talking about Europeans, who knows what that means? Source development could result in detection and prevention of black identity extremist activities. Believe me, this source development is talking about includes you. When I say it includes you, it includes people that look like you, because these things can't be detected unless you help them. They couldn't have stopped Nat Turner unless source development helped them. They couldn't have stopped Denmark Vesey unless source development helped. And I'm using that term loosely, source development.
Right.
It couldn't have stopped these men, Gabriel Prosser. It couldn't have stopped those men if they didn't have source development. And that's why Sister Harriet Tubman carried a gun, because she was going to make sure that no source development helped detect her.
In the period of brother was speaking of, Brandon was speaking of, I might be wrong, but something I seen where William Mercer Cook was a American diplomat in the 60s, and he in his book about black writers said that he seen that the blacks of the U.S. and of England were the most radicalized. This is someone who came through Kennedy and through, you know, the programs of, you know, the, the Peace Corps, you know, and dealing with Senegal, you know, three of the African countries. So, you know, it's when you talk about source development, it will come in all kind of ways in being able to say the perceived, and I don't know, like you said, the perceived aspect of it, but the tangible thing is, like, the perceived is what's supposed to be the initiating, but what they tangibly will do is create a separate homeland out of that perceived threat that they feel, black people. They would want to create their own separate, autonomous, self-governing activity. Now, I don't. They ain't say that they're gonna blow up no buildings, that they're gonna kill nobody, that they want to govern themselves.
Yeah, but that's unacceptable, Richard. That's unacceptable. Anything that black people do, whether it's Black Lives Matter, Movement for Black Lives, whatever, they'll join in. As long as they can control the narrative. If you're talking about doing something independent of their input, that's unacceptable. And black people need to understand that. Now, maybe some black folks is assimilationists. They don't care whether their lives are controlled by anybody else. And that's a true fact. Some people don't care. They're assimilationists. But for anybody that values their ancestors' opinions, that valued their lives, and know that our ancestors was independent and free people, then you got to understand that these people, let's go to the phones. You know what? And let me mention this also, because we see all this stuff happening. And for some of our people, it's fascinating when they see all of a sudden white folks talking about, oh, they realize now it's discrimination. When in government documents last year, they said it was only perceived. Look at this article here from a published report in Face to Face Africa, Richard, and it was, when was this date? 2 weeks ago? It says discrimination against blacks costs U.S. economy $16 trillion. The United States' longstanding discrimination against blacks is biting the U.S. economy hard. A new U.S. report, a new report by U.S.-based firm Citigroup, claims that U.S. economy lost $16 trillion due to racism and discrimination faced by blacks since the year 2000. So, Richard, being that everything that this man does has some type of financial bottom line, you don't think that his so-called relaxing certain laws and all of a sudden black people is his friends got anything to do with this? Do you think it's any relation to that?
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones and see what the callers have to say. Let's go to 602. 602.
Yes, brothers. Good evening. Brother Marcos here.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, brothers. You know, it reminds me again of that what Dr. Amos Wilson stated, that white folks, Muzungus, are, one-tenth or one-ninth of the world's population. So in order for them to rule, they have to recruit from the same group of people that they are oppressing. But what strikes me is that in light of what is happening now, we see the current state of affairs with the country. But our people, these flunkies, are still holding on. You know, these flunky junkies are still holding on, saying, oh, you know, they're willing to destroy their own people. Because, you know, what you said about the FBI report, you know, that means the FBI can come out and say they are nationalists. They are black nationalists. You see, they could float a flunky out there and put him and then draw other people, you see, other black folks, to. So it's insanity. Again, our people are really, really, something is really fundamentally wrong with the way we are thinking. We see this ship is sinking, but we still, you know, want to go down with the ship. Don't want to save themselves. You know, it's ridiculous. It is just ridiculous. But there is hope, you know, because there is a movement of black people who are moving to the continent. There is that movement. So I am very hopeful, you know. A lot of people going to go down with the ship, though, brother. Mm-hmm. But some of them, we don't need them anywhere. If they're willing to go down with him, let them go down with him. We don't need them. You know, because they're going to give us more problem on the motherland. That is where we have to put our effort. Because when the motherland gets strong, then she can help our people. China is, they're not lynching Chinese people because China has 1.4 billion Chinese there, and he got a big ass army ready to respond. Until we get to that stage, it's going to continue. These people, they're not going to change. They only change in the face of power. You see, I read something where Mao Zedong said, he said, political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. And we trying to march for change. We trying to sing for change. We trying to hope for change. These people, they only change a little bit when it's convenient for them. They'll back up on the rope. And then our people will think, oh, yeah, you see, they're backing down. No, that is just a tactic they're using. When they regroup and get stronger, they come and attack again. So, you know, we're running on a treadmill with these people there. They're not going to change. The more things change, the more they stay the same. But there is hope. There is hope. Look to the east. Anyway, good brothers, you take care. And thank you so much for this program. Keep on keeping on. Mute me. I'm still here.
Talk to you soon.
All right.
Let's go to 215. 215?
Hey, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, how y'all brothers doing tonight?
How is it?
I'm doing fine. All praise be to Allah. You know, Brother Elliot, when you mentioned about control and stuff like that, how these people, they got to control the narrative. In the recent issue of The Final Call, they've been doing a series of the last two or three issues of The Final Call about the Zionist Jewish influence on black people. And just like you correctly said, Brother Elliot, they said that in the NAACP might have to be a so-called black, we're so-called black, but they got a white mind, and they said in there how they control, even right today, how whites can run the show. You know, they dictate what's the agenda going to be for black people and stuff. That's in the present-day NAACP, which is no different than what it was back during the days of W.E.B. Du Bois. So we see clearly nothing has changed with that, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, that's very clear. And I want Brother Jay to, I'm sure he'd be calling right after me. I want Jay to confirm something because I didn't know. Not that I'm surprised, but, you know, with this thing about masks, because, you know, De Blasio, the mayor of New York, he's threatening to shut essential places down again because of the so-called, because the surge in the virus. But I heard on the mainstream media, their media, that Hasidic Jews in New York, these are the same ones that they ran over that little black child up in New York several years ago, and you had all that stuff going on, and you had that old handkerchief head, David Dinkins, and all that old mess back then. But my point is that I heard the Hasidic Jews up in New York, they are exempt because of their religion. They don't have to wear a mask in public, they can go into places without a mask on because of their religious exemption. And I'm saying to myself, well, I know Muslims, and Muslims abide by the rules, but I know Muslims, I've seen them in places here in Philadelphia, Ellen and Richard, and to the town from the wicked listen audience. I've seen Muslim sisters and Muslim brothers. They go into banks and stuff, and they had their masks and stuff on. What makes them so damn special, Elliot? You know what I mean? Why is they exempt from it? Because they wouldn't get exemptions to no Muslims. So why should they get it? You know. And also I too heard, Elliot, that over in Israel, that you got a group of Jewish people. I think they might be the Orthodox, but I can't, don't hold me. But I know it's a group of Jews. They get special privileges. You know, in Israel, when you reach a certain age and stuff, like 16 or 17, you're supposed to go, you know, join the Israeli military. That's be part of your service. But it's a group of Jews over there that they're exempt from that. They don't have to. They get exemption. They said the average Jew over there is upset about that, the double standard. So, I mean, I'm like saying to myself, what is it about these people they get these special privileges and stuff, man? I tell you, man. I just, like I said, when Brother Jay called, I hope he can, you know, confirm that and stuff, whether that happens in New York with the Hasidic Jews, that they don't have, they can walk around and go in a public place without any mask on, and nobody's allowed to say anything to them. I would like to know that, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Because, again, like I said, I don't live in New York, but that's what I heard on one of the news outlets and stuff, you know. But, you know, on the police and everything that's going on, yeah, like you said, you know, all this stuff, again, you see these police, they got these ties to these white supremacist groups. Because, again, I mentioned on Terrestrial Radio Show today, and they say this a couple of things I get off so other calls could get on. I said on Terrestrial Radio here in Philadelphia today, and the commentator had to agree. I said, well, why is it that these Jewish groups that have no problem jumping all over Minister Rodney or Minister Farrakhan or Leonard Jefferson, anybody else that dare, Sister McKinney, that dare challenge them, the treatment of black people, not only in Israel, but the black people in the United States and around the world, people of color, black people in particular, their mistreatment, you call it anti-Semite. I said, but when white people say anything or do anything against these so-called white Jews, it's silence. Well, I posed the question to the commentator this morning. I said, when the Proud Boys met with the FOP, now, you know, the Proud Boys, is, you know, they got a group of white bigots that don't like black people, obviously, but they don't like Jews either. They don't like the Jews either, or so they claim. So I'm saying to myself, when the FOP, which is supposed to be a police union representing the interests of police officers, when they fraternized with the Proud Boys here in Philadelphia about a month and a half ago, whatever it was, why didn't you hear her? Not one echo from these Jewish groups, the ones that they had no problem coming out with swift condemnation against DeSean Jackson, the Eagles football player, Minister Rodney. But when the Proud Boys met with the FOP and was fraternized and throwing back a couple of cold brewskis with them, eating barbecue, I didn't hear one word from the ADL,
from the Jewish Federation. All these ones, they jumped, had no problem, Ellen and Richard, jumping out against Minister Rodney and Deshaun J. They were silent. But see, there's a reason for that because, again, it's been said. It's not nothing I'm saying. It's out of this, no shock. The reason why they go after black people, they consider black people a soft target. They know that black people is not going to retaliate. No, they're not going to come at them with no economic punishment. They sure ain't going to come at them with no physical punishment, like violence or anything and stuff. So they know. So they know with black people, you can jump on us anything. But they know with these white extremists, if they say anything, they know these white people will kill them. And that's the bottom. I'm not going to sugarcoat. They know they will kill them. Because you've seen acts of violence committed with this white man in Pittsburgh a couple years ago. And by the way, when that horrific incident happened with this white man shot the synagogue in Pittsburgh, the same people who they despise and they condemn all the time was the first ones to come to their aid. And I know this for a fact. It was a cross-section of Muslims in the Pittsburgh area. Members of the Nation of Islam, other Muslim groups came and not only donated blood to the Jews, they had a blood drive for the Jews that didn't die, that was wounded, a blood drive. They even raised money to help the Jewish people in that synagogue bury their dead. You know, the same people who they call anti-Semitic and hate us and stuff, they was the ones that came to their aid. How ironic is that, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, you know? So I'm just saying is that these people, they are so cowardly, and so they only go after black people who they perceive as weak. But when these white extremists, men and women, say and do anything against them, they don't open up their mouth. You know what I mean? So, you know, then this stuff has got to be dealt with, and this double standard hypocrisy has got to be exposed so we can throw off that yoke of Jewish influence on black people. Because I'm telling y'all, in Richard, in closing, we as black people, we'll never achieve our status in life or reach the plateau that we want to reach if we can't stop this Jewish control, because the control they have on black people in this country is more deeper than you think, man. It's a sad commentary. They can actually tell black people at black radio stations, black schools, who to have as a guest, who to have on the radio. Who, if they can go to these black HBCUs and tell them don't have Farrakhan speak then, and a lot of these handkerchiefs, the same niggas you seen hanging around Donald Trump at the White House, they're capitulating a heartbeat. You know what I mean? And we can't have this, Elliot. We cannot have this. If we're gonna have true self determination as a people, this cannot be tolerated, brother. It just cannot be.
Well, they don't have control of black people. They have control of a lot of black leadership.
Right, that's
so
what I'm going to say.
That's the difference. Right. Yeah, I mean, if we get some of these so-called leaders from in front of the people, then we can have a better view of what we're doing. They have control of the leadership of black people, and they cultivate that leadership. So when these people get to those levels, they know they got them in their pocket.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's exactly. They don't have control of black people. They got control of black leadership.
You're right. Now, that's a fair point, Elliot. And last point, Elliot, on the terrestrial radio, so your experienced congressman, Elliot, you know, the one that represents the West Oak Lane area, Elliot, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The congressman. Well, he was trying to talk tough on black radio. They told him he liked the host. He's an angry black man. I said, I almost fell out my chair when this Negro said this. Told him he's angry, and he gets upset when he see how black people being treated, and he had to control. I said, man, you cowardly, spineless Negro, please. He remembers the same individual that said he had a bill for the Palestinian children. Just the same individual that said he didn't know anything about that blue bill, the police bill. I mean, these Negroes, boy, I'm telling you, they about as fraudulent as a $2 bill with Donald Trump's picture on it, man. You got these Negroes are so fraudulent, man. It's a joke. It's almost laughable, these clowns, man. He's upset. I said, upset about what? Please. But anyway, Elliot, thanks for your time. I get off, man. Put me on mute, Elliot, and I'll listen to the rest of the show, good brother.
All right. Thanks for your call. And we got 7 more minutes to go, and let's go to our final caller in the last 7 minutes of the program. 646.
Hey, what's going on, Richard and Elliot? Hey, Little Joe, you are, I think, right about that Jew, but I can't really verify it. I think that they don't have to wear masks, but I'm pretty sure that they do. But because they're in such a small community and they basically don't go outside of that community, that's probably why they don't wear the mask. Now, in that community, that they control, it's very few other ethnic groups in the community. So, I mean, probably the percentage is maybe 10%. So, I'm assuming that that's what it is. Yeah, they basically would be in a situation to maybe spread it. And the other communities, I think there's none that they want to close down. Maybe two of them have, two or three have a Jewish population, so they may have, you know, traded communities or maybe going back and forth. But, hey, the bottom line is, you know, they're trying to keep this situation under some degree of control because, in all truthfulness, man, it's absolutely wreak havoc on the economy in New York City. I mean, it's worse than what they are letting on. You know what I mean? I mean, it's bad. It's not going to get no better, I don't think, because, you know, it depends. It depends in New York State. Really, everything boils down to if Fredo gets back in office. If Fredo gets back in office, you can forget about New York State. Because, like I've said, the governor doesn't want to tax the rich. Now, you know, the funny thing is, out in California, I got a couple of people I know out in California, and they were telling me that the wealthy out there, they get the hell taxed out of them, and they don't mind, because, you know, they're making money. Here in New York, there's a great fear of taxing the rich, so that's keeping a lot of revenue from coming in. I mean, I know, probably not this year coming up, but next year I know I'm going to have a hell of a tax bill. I know I'm preparing for my taxes to go up around 20%, and that's a lot. And I know it's probably not going to be that much, but that's what everything that I'm doing, I'm preparing for 20 because I know how bad it's going to get. And the way it looks, everybody's talking about Fredo may not get back in office, but I'm pretty sure Fredo's going to get back in office. And because I'm just going to watch how they're going to spend this thing that, you know, just happened with them. I'm just disappointed that the ancestors and the Sky Daddy ain't brought his ass upstairs. You know, they done allowed him to stay down there to continue his evil. It's time they really take him. But for some reason, I guess the ancestors may have someone better in mind that they need to get. Maybe it could be Mitch. I think McConnell is worse than Trump anyway. But, yeah, I don't know. It's funny how you notice Mitch was nowhere around in none of this. If you will recall, he wasn't even there Saturday from when they all got sick, it seems. When they was making the announcement for this woman to become the Supreme Court judge, that's where it seems everybody got sick at. And then it seems like it was confirmed around Wednesday. The president knew and whatever, he just didn't give a damn. So the reality is, we just see how it moves forward. I mean, these next 30 days, you're going to see a lot of Negroes acting in a panic state of mind, putting extreme pressure to figure out how they could get this jokester out of office. You're going to see where the black community is going to come out in droves or imply that they're coming out in droves. But I just want the people to be clear of one thing. Never allow this white man to blame you for putting this bastard back in the office. The only reason the bastard's going to get back in the office is voter suppression and the Supreme Court. That's the only reason he's going to get back in office. Now, if there wasn't voter suppression, it's no way he could do it. If they're able to get this woman confirmed before the election or a little bit after election, then he's just going to get in. He's going to skate in. So never let nobody tell you, please, that black folks didn't come out to vote and they did this and they did that like they did for that white devil Hillary Clinton. No, the only reason she lost was because of voter suppression. So, I mean, we as a people are going to have to stand up and address and deal with that situation when the time comes. Now, as stand down and stand by in regards to this whole white supremacist thing, listen, man, let's be honest. Our people ain't prepared for this white boy if this white boy decides he want to come and attack us. You know, let's just keep it 100, man. The Negro tried to integrate with this cracker every chance he get. You know, I listen and I hear people talk about they want to separate from the white man. Okay, I agree with that. But my question is, whenever you talk about separating from the white man in this country, could you just please identify to me how you going to take care of your black ass? Could you tell me, are you going to get up and drive 100 miles to your job? When you separate from them, are you going to be able to get a job from a black business or sustain yourself without needing the white man at all? You know, I mean, why would you want to separate yourself from the cracker here? Why don't you separate yourself and go back home and identify someplace where they're doing that type of salvagery work? They got a group like our good brother Oshie. Had on a couple of weeks ago, the Ledge Group. They got other groups of brothers and sisters who coming together in other countries that are doing the do. Why do your black behind want to separate and stay here and be embedded in a certain sense to the white man for a job, for your survival, for your security, for everything, basically? If you want to struggle like that and you want to be separated from the white man, leave and go home. Stop talking about getting a piece of land here and building up a piece of land here and then still be embedded to the white man on some level. That's silliness. That's not clear thinking. But for some reason, we think that that's clear thinking. That's not clear thinking to me. Because, let's be clear, and I always get in trouble for it, but I have to say, most of the people that I know in the Nation of Islam work for the white man, one way or another. I mean, I know a few that have their own businesses and all of that, but a great deal of them work for the white man. So now you say you're going to separate from the cracker, from the white man. How you going to feed your family? How you going to take care of yourself? You build the institutions where you think black people are going to support it to the point to where you can take care of yourself and your family? Unfortunately, sorry to say it, I don't mean to sound so harsh about it, but we don't support ourselves like that. Because if we supported ourselves like that, we would be in a whole other level. But hey, listen, you know, all I can say is let's keep trying. Let's keep trying to figure it out. Let's hook up with groups like the Ledge Group. Let's hook up with other people. Let's place ourselves in a position to where we can find some sort of sovereignty for this madness. Let's educate our children. That was the greatest time ever for our people to educate our children independently. The greatest time ever. You give it more material and opportunity to educate your children now than you ever have. So, hey, listen, all I can say is this. We got to stand up and fight on whatever level we can to move ourselves forward. As far as also the Dog and Pony show of, I think it was Tuesday night, Fredo and, you know, Sleepy. Yo, man, Sleepy had so many opportunities to put the death nail into Fredo, but he never pulled the trigger, man. He never pulled the trigger. It just showed you that Joe ain't that sharp, man. And the sad thing is, unfortunately, our people think that when Joe get in office, things are going to get better for us. But, man, if you really, honestly, took the time out to look at the record of this white man for the 40-some years that he's been in office, the man has really done more to harm, you know, black people than most have. He's on the level of a Strong Furman. He's really on the level of a Mitch McConnell. And he's really on the level of a Lindsey Graham of today. I mean, you know, to be honest, the man's record is a disaster. Let's look at what he's done, the crime bill. Let's look at what he's done with the police reform. Let's look at something that's affecting the lives of more people today than we even imagine or we even want to address and be honest about. The bankruptcy reform. He was a central player in the bankruptcy reform. I was reading Stephanie Rule.
Well, I don't want to go down memory lane with this guy, but wind it up so we can get ready.
Well, let me wind it up on this note. I was reading a post by Twitter by Stephanie Rule, the host on MSNBC. And she asked the question to white folks, how are they doing in this time of COVID? And you know, man, she had thousands and thousands of replies. And a couple of them really hit me, man. And this is the thing that hit me. You had professionals who lost their jobs, who cannot get a job in their 60s, who basically know ain't nobody going to hire them, now have to go out there and collect Social Security. Before they collect Social Security, they got to mess with their 401ks and run through their savings before they could get Social Security. And the thing that really shocked me was this white woman said that her and her husband, 60-some years old, think about this all, were going to get Social Security, and that half of their Social Security money was going to go back to paying student loans, and that they will never, ever probably be able to pay it off till the time they die. And do you know there's a whole bunch of people out there caught up in that trick bag? And nobody's talking about the economic crises that everyday Americans are facing. So, you know, if white people catch it out, we really in big trouble. So I would just hope that we get our act together and see what's really going on and what's really happening to us as African people and just move forward. And Brother Richard and Brother Elliot, may y'all have an enjoyable week. And, hey, just do what you do. Thank you again, my brothers. And little Joe, the Jew is the devil. So the devil don't have to wear a mask.
Talk to you soon.
Hotel.
Mm-hmm. Let me grab this last call. Let me grab this last call here. 4444.
Hey, I appreciate that. Elliot, that's good, man. You say you're the best for last, man. You let me just stay online so I can meditate on it. Hey, look here, Richard. You got the computer, Richard. And look here, Richard, I want you to go to a Democracy Now! Punch in on Troy Davis in 2010, Democracy Now! That's a receipt for me, man. But I've been out here in the fight a long time, bro. I don't be just sitting here meditating. I want y'all to pull that up, man. Put that on your collage. My interview, what I called for Georgia. In 2010, I confronted Sharpton, Ben Jealous, and the guy that's running for senator. Okay? And what I said, I bring receipts, bro. So I appreciate it, man. You saved me to the end, man. Hey, I've been out here in the fight a long time, man. That's why I'm not out here asking nobody for just ice. Okay? That's all. Y'all quit using just ice in 2010, man. So anybody can keep saying justice, y'all are going to get just ice in about 2 months, man. Okay, that's what I try to show y'all, how the words work before you go out there in the streets, before you go out there confronting these people talking about, I heard one of your callers talking about anal lies. Okay, what is your anal? What you sit on, and the lies are false stories. All right? So I bring the words and I bring the plan too, man. But I've been out there in the streets, Elliot. All right? Because I'm glad you played Cynthia McKinney. Because I'm just an old black man from Georgia. And what we do is, if I have a disagreement with somebody, I talk to them. Okay? A lot of y'all callers, I done heard them, got disagreements with somebody on another show, and they won't even call the cat that they got a disagreement. They want to complain on your show, man. Okay? And then one more thing about this Trump is not paying no taxes. I want to ask you and Richard something. But y'all pay somebody to bust you upside the head?
No.
I'm Richard.
No.
Okay, that's what we're doing every time, y'all. We pay taxes. We paying the police to bust us upside the head, man. Okay, we got 40 million people. Now, what if we say, well, we tired. This is the only way we're going to stop them, we quit paying them. 40 million, I say, we ain't paying no taxes. You keep the stimulus taxes. I watch it. I pay somebody to whoop my ass, man. That's stupidity to me, bro. Y'all just chew on that, man. Y'all going to be on Friday, right?
Yes, sir.
All right, I appreciate it. I love y'all, man. You know what I'm saying? But, Elliot, pull it up, man. I want to hear Michael Lodge on there. Democracy Now. Yes, sir. Democracy Now, Troy Davis, when I was talking to Amy Goodman. Okay, this is how we do it in Georgia, man. I put my black behind on the line when I call for economic sanctions against Georgia. All right, that's what I do. Put it on Rich on the tell I bid you. Okay, Amy Good. I want to hear Michael Lodge Friday next Sunday, man.
You want to hear it? What's the name of it?
Yes, sir. It's go to Troy Davis. You know Amy Good on Democracy Now, right?
Okay, you Democracy Now.
From October 10th, I think, 2010, the night when they killed Troy Davis in Georgia. I know y'all familiar with that story. When they accused him of the same thing, they accused Ahmaud Jamal up there where y'all at. They did the same thing to Troy Davis. And so we was at the prison trying to get that brother out, man. Okay? That's why I don't do no talking about no Just Ice and all that. I wore a lot of my energy out, so I had to change my strategy on my words and what I do. But y'all put it up, man. 2010, Amy Gooden, just put in Troy Davis, Democracy Not, and you will see what Big West had to say. I got that receipt, man. I don't like to toot my own horn because my lip's big enough. Last time I played the trumpet was in eighth grade. But I got receipts, man.
All right.
I love y'all, man. But pull it up. I want to hear the collage, man. You, Richard, pull it up. You see who I am, what I do, bro. Okay?
All right.
I don't be just damn meditating, man. I've been out here. But I love y'all, man. I've been putting it up, man. Put mine in the mix.
All right. We'll talk to you.
I love y'all.
Please.
Take care, man.
So, Richard?
Yep.
You know what you got to do.
I see.
before we leave this evening, let me.
I got homework.
Before we leave this evening, let me tell you about the lineup. On Time for an Awakening Media, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Always interesting subject matter and dialogue on African Perspectives. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. from 6 to 8. Later that evening, Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. That's on Monday evening, 6 to 8. On Time for an Awakening Media from 8 to 9. Black Therapy Central with host Dr. Maria Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban. That's 8 to 9 on Monday on Time for an Awakening Media. On the first and third Mondays of every month, Conversation Reparations, which is Nkoba's program, they aired last Monday, so they won't be on this Monday. And you'll probably catch them next Monday, the first to third. No, probably 2 weeks, but I'll let you know. Tuesday, 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, from 7 to 9, after 7 with host Shani B. On Fridays, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. on Saturdays from 4 to 6, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers, and later Saturday evening from 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins, and then Time for Inner Awakening is back on Sunday from 7 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. Children, to save the children.